Good movies, like any good story, take us out of ourselves and push us into someone else. Empathizing, sympathizing, viewing the world from a new angle. Stories can make us different people. My years of talking about classic and important films on the podcast Lost in Criterion have led to some amazingly formative, film-inspired conversations about theology and philosophy, sometimes coming from movies that just don't seem that religious or philosophical on their surface. Ever since we first talked about Bergman's Seventh Seal, I've been itching to talk more explicitly about religion in film. To scratch that itch comes this podcast, in which I'm inviting anyone to talk to me about the film with the most religious meaning to them, however they define religion, and however they define meaning. Welcome to Cinema Credo, conversations on film and faith. I'm Adam Glass.
Strength and mercy for me. And from me every day, life and light will bleed into love.
I'm Brother Thanasi, and I live in Blacklick, Ohio, and I was raised in New York City. I am a monk in the Episcopal Church under the Community of the Gospel, and I chose The Last Temptation of Christ because it floored me when it came out in the 80s as a movie. It fascinated me as a book in my childhood.
Tom, who I know as Thanasi or Athanasios, is an old friend and is one of the reasons this podcast exists. Thinking about talking with him about this film in particular is one of the seeds that led me to establishing this podcast, and I'm so glad to have him for my first episode. Now, when did you first read it?
I read it either in 7th or 8th grade.
Okay. And that would have been... what, 1960? Or...
the 66 to 68, somewhere around there. Yeah.
The book came out in 55 in Greece. It was actually really controversial even when the book came out. The film, we can talk about the controversy too, but the book itself was very controversial. It took an active Greek legislature to get it published, but it ended up being very popular in 55, and obviously by 67 you weren't reading it in Greek.
No, I was reading it in English. I was fascinated with several things that Nikos Kazantzakis had written. And the one that most people don't realize that I love the most is his Francis, as is in Francis of Assisi. Retelling of Francis and his life. And it's probably the most sacred thing I've ever read.
You had read that prior to?
Before. I come out of a Greek family. My mom's people. And of course, they think Nikos Kazantzakis was the demon himself because they were very loyal Orthodox.
This is not exactly an Orthodox tale of Jesus.
Right. But when I read the book, I could see everything that was in the Gospels being explained in a different way, but a plausible way of what could have happened in the time of Christ.
Right. When we started watching it today, the title card pops up. It says it's not based on the Gospels, but is based on, an idea, the mental state of Jesus. And then you immediately said, well, and the Gospels.
And, definitely. I wasn't well-educated in... the research that was going on in to the origins of the Gospels at that point. But over the next 20 years, I realized that he was cutting edge when it came to responding to what the scholars and researchers were doing in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And when the movie came out, I had just read the great work of Dr. Helmut Keister or Coaster of Harvard University, his two-volume New Testament. And what this is the first volume is background material on the Hellenistic Age, and the second volume is what, at that point in the 1980s, they knew about the development of the Gospels and the whole New Testament. And you read this, and part of this stuff comes right from the 50s when he got his master's degree, and you're going like, oh my God, Nikos Kazantzakis absorbed all this and regurgitated it and synthesized it using the Gospels and came up with this incredible, plausible history of Christ.
Yeah.
And of course, everybody in the 1980s got flipped out at when a movie first came out because, oh my God, Jesus gets married and isn't on the cross. And you got to go, guys, that's a fictional fantasy at the end of the movie as a possible temptation of Christ.
Not understanding anything about what the movie is actually doing.
And I was living in San Francisco at the time, and the most amazing thing happened. The Archbishop of the Roman Catholic Church for San Francisco, John Quinn, literally issued a statement saying that people should go see it and realize it's not what the Gospels have contained within it, but it would be good discussion for reading and studying the Gospels. And I was shocked because here's the Archbishop of the Roman Catholic Church saying this.
Yeah.
And I went.
And that's very interesting. There was a lot of pushback from across Christian communities. The founder of Campus Crusade offered to buy the movie from Paramount so that he could burn the negatives. And a lot of Catholic pushback, both in the U.S., but in France, there were theaters firebombed for showing this movie in France by right-wing Catholics.
Well, that's great, because I had to go through a picket line, and I was attending the movie the first time with two Roman Catholic priests of the Paulist order.
Do you remember their response to the movie?
They were far more liberal than I'll ever be. And they loved it. And again, we all afterwards in my parish, we talked about the movie and what is gospel, what's different in the gospel, why is it different, and so we had people learning more and more about the Holy Scriptures, not less.
Plus,
they gained a strong respect for Martin Scorsese and Nikos Kazantzakis for this movie.
Yeah, this movie really made Scorsese a household name in a lot of ways.
He wasn't before?
He really wasn't. His career wasn't that great before. It really... You think 87 is Scorsese, but it's interesting... In the other project I do for film, Lost in Criterion, we talk about Martin Scorsese a lot because his fingers are everywhere in supporting old film and getting it back into view. He'll talk about, Martin Scorsese will remember that he saw clips of something on television, on public access TV in New York City when he was a kid, and he will spend the rest of his life seeking out that film and finally get a distributable copy of it. And that story, or a story like that, pops up so much about Scorsese. But as a director, this made him more of a household name than anything, just because people who weren't even into movies suddenly were into the controversy, right? The controversy
Yeah.
makes people know who he is.
But it really didn't do well as a film, financially. And of course, it's a 3-hour long psychological look at Jesus. You know, it's not going to have a wide audience, but it only opened on 200 screens across the country. And with a budget of $8 million, they made $7 million. There was one interesting quote I ran across about Scorsese in the aftermath of this movie, that there were people making more money going on talk shows talking about, complaining about The Last Temptation than Scorsese made from The Last Temptation.
Now, and I think the estate of Kazantzakis had an upswing in sales of books.
I'm certain.
Because I remember seeing the book republished and people reading it.
Yeah. Tell you about this movie making money. Another interesting story about it is throughout Latin America, this movie was banned when it came out. The church politic suppressed it. It's actually still banned in the Philippines and Singapore as of today.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but it was banned in Mexico until 2004. And it actually ended up premiering in Mexico at the same time as The Passion of the Christ. And there are suggestions that it made so much money in Mexico when it premiered in 2004, not necessarily because people were interested in seeing The Last Temptation, but because they thought they were going to see the Mel Gibson movie and bought the wrong ticket.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
But there... They're interesting companion pieces too.
Yes.
Yeah, it's doing. They're obviously doing very different things, but you know, Gibson, so much in so many ways, is wanting to reinforce a certain view, but also hammer home certain things that people maybe kind of believe, but don't necessarily, about the violence of it and the sacrifice. The movie here, Last Temptation, still suggests a penal substitution crucifixion in ways, and the way you're acting, I think you're going to say something about that.
Yes,
feel free.
Well, it's in the movie. It definitely the whole atonement theory, where Jesus had to sacrifice his body, had to be killed as the perfect sacrifice to end what Adam and Eve started with original sin in the Catholic Church. And I thought that was like, that's so not Orthodox.
Right.
As far as Greek Orthodox, where Kazantzakis would have been... his base of his faith journey. And it's the speech by the Apostle Paul at one point, who is at the end of the movie, is talking about that death has ended,
right?
That he defeated death. That's the primary understanding of the Orthodox theology.
Christ victorious.
That Christ had to die so he could defeat death for all of us.
Right.
And so, to see the Western overview in the Scorsese film,
yes,
really, it irks me a little bit more today than back then.
Yeah, I understand that too. I come out of an American Protestant background. And in my background, obviously, I was what, 3 when this movie came out, so I don't remember the controversy firsthand. But this has been a movie that is always controversial within Protestant circles, and I suppose probably still controversial in a lot of Catholic circles too. I come from a background that ideologically favors a spiritualization of Christianity, even while they don't favor a spiritualness. it's sort of hard to explain without having come out of it. But Christianity, in my background, in a lot of ways, was just about heaven. And Jesus is... the gospel is the virgin birth, the crucifixion, the resurrection, the second coming. And that's the whole. We're going to go to heaven because of what Jesus did, but there's very much an ignoring of what Jesus did on earth, an ignoring of what I now view as his humanity. Instead favoring this divine mission, but the divine mission itself is not emphasized as something spiritual. Spiritualism is again, something very different to what those Protestant faiths are trying to push.
Well, it's funny you bring this up.
Yeah.
So I just recently read a book by N.T. Wright, who's a retired bishop in the Anglican Church.
Yes.
And he wrote a book, Surprised by Hope. And it's all about what to expect, what happens when we pass away in this from this life.
Yeah.
And one thing a lot of modern Christians ignore is the resurrection of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
In Revelations, it says clearly that there'll be a new heaven and a new earth, and with it, the resurrection of all.
Yeah.
And that's when the judgment seat and all that stuff happens, and we can talk about that later, about the judgment seat. But what N.T. Wright's biggest point was that the kingdom of God starts now.
Right.
And that everything that you do in the cause of making things just and right and helping people and not judging and loving, as Jesus says in this movie,
yes.
Love,
yes.
Love, love, it's all will add to this final new creation of the heaven and earth.
Right.
That from who we were and from what the planet and the universe is, God will make new. He will not throw it away. And that any concept of us going to heaven and that's the final place, no. The final place is here on earth in a bodily form, as in 1 Corinthians chapter 15.
And the last image of Revelation, as you said, is
right.
The kingdom come. And the,
but real Jesus' kingdom. Body is discussed in utmost detail in chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. In that regard, I really love the humanity of Jesus in this film. Jesus isn't a divine being so much as a in the film, how can I say this without how can I actually represent what I'm trying to say, I guess is what I'm trying to think. The Jesus of this film isn't a being who cannot sin. He is a person who chooses not to sin.
Okay, first of all, this word sin,
yeah.
To me, the concept of sin is a human being cuts off communications with God.
Right.
He turns his back on God.
Okay.
So Jesus can never turn his back on himself. So he's sinless.
Yes.
In that definition.
Okay.
Now, did he have trespasses? Did he do bad things? That's not sin.
Okay.
Or iniquity, whatever you want to call it, but it's not sin. And it's what we all do, even when we're sinless. And Jesus obviously was very human.
Yeah.
the whole theology that we have fought for since the beginning of the church is that Jesus was fully human and fully divine.
Right.
So anything you or I experience, he has experienced. That's why the movie's The Last Temptation, right, a temptation any human being would have.
Right. That's, you talked earlier about one of the responses to this movie being people sort of misunderstanding that whole final sequence, that the idea that...
yeah, not my Jesus.
Right. Yeah, and it's obvious... It's obvious that that is a, it's meant to be the titular temptation, and it's right on the, it's on the cover, right?
Yeah.
The idea that this is happy, and in so many ways, this is a, it's a fairly long movie, and the half hour, the first half hour is a little slow, honestly, but it is all built up to that final 45 minutes, and what that means of him being tempted. And other than that, it's a very accurate and good, you know, accurate enough retelling of the Gospels. You know, the Gospels compared to themselves are not, you know, there's four in the canon for a reason, right? They all say slightly different things. They give slightly different timelines. So.
Well, I like that the movie portrays Jesus, Judas,
yeah,
and Mary Magdalene as real people.
Right.
And, you know, if you want to accept that Mary Magdalene was a whore, as Leo the Great declared she was 600 years after,
right,
that's fine. But it, whatever her problems, it, the way this movie presents it, it was a very human way that she and Jesus were close, and she had expectations that were not met.
Right.
And she became something bad afterwards, which Jesus helped reconcile in the end. So, and Jesus, just earthy. You know, this is not the Jesus that has no dirt on him.
Right.
He's the Jesus of sweat and blood and filth, and how the movie suggests at the very beginning what he was doing as a carpenter,
right,
was probably the most horrific thing you could think of for Christ to be doing.
Right. He is, the beginning of the film, he is the carpenter producing crosses, producing for the empire the weapon of extermination for himself later on. Execution for himself.
Well, the crucifixion was reserved in the Roman Empire to scare and intimidate the population, and it was reserved not for everybody, but for those that they were trying to make an example of.
Right.
You don't want to go against us, Rome.
Right.
You don't want to go against Caesar, and this is what will happen if you do. And it's a humiliating, torturous, horrible, indignant death. And I really think the one thing wrong with this movie, the crowds were a lot smaller than they should have been.
Yeah.
If anyone knows anything about public executions, they bring in large quantities of people who want to see it. Just as our gory movies are today, and we have large crowds that go see them, people loved hangings, people loved torturous deaths.
That has been true for
the beginning.
Millennia.
Yeah.
One thing I absolutely love about this movie is the way it portrays the disciples almost immediately getting the words of Christ wrong over and over and over again.
Yeah.
No, I was talking about love, not about killing. I was.
Let's go kill, murder the rich.
One, I think, perhaps even more subtle instance, just because it's the build up to the zealotry at the temple, is him saying, "You know, to fight the devil wherever he is, in the sick, in the rich, and in even in the temple, and it's still the devil and the sick is healing the sick. The devil and the rich is raising up the poor and overthrowing oppression. The devil in the temple is oppressive too.
Yes. Here.
But immediately that explodes into a riot, right? And into torches and swords. Even as he has spent the last years telling them, no, it's about love. It's about love. It can't be, can't be about killing. I think of something Tolstoy said in The Kingdom of God is Within You in that aspect too, that how easily the disciples lost the plot, that the last thing Jesus says is everybody's in. And by the time we get to the first chapter of Acts, it's arguing who's in and who's out.
Yes, yes. And it's amazing because we have all sorts of filters and of ways in by the time we've come to this point in our history in the Christian church, where if you suggest that everybody's in, that everybody is saved, they'll look at you like you're crazy. But if you do a detailed study of just the letter of Romans,
right,
you'll find out Paul was thinking everybody's in.
Right.
And you look at the early church fathers, the people that wrote in the hundreds and 200s and 300s and 400s, they're all assuming that somehow God's going to work it out for everybody.
Right.
And it's only with the beginning plagues in the late 500s into the 600s do you have Christianity doing something which I consider perverse. It starts saying, you're in, you're out, you're no good for eternity. You have eternity. You have a torturous hell. And none of that stuff is reflected in the first 500 years of Christianity. Yeah. It's a set of lies from the Dark Ages, and we're still living under it.
Now, politically, that lines up with Constantine coming along with the church too. Do you think that the political power of the church at that time led into that sort of stuff?
I think so. Yeah. Definitely. Constantine, when he the Edict of Milan, where he makes Christianity allowable in the empire. And then by the time he himself becomes a Christian, he is using the Christianity in a way as a propaganda tool of the empire, as a tool to prop up the empire.
Right.
And that's the beginning of the manipulations. He himself used vast wealth to influence individual bishops.
Yeah.
The Bishop of Rome was given the Lateran Palace as one little toy. he did this over all of the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
He was trying to get people lined up to be on his side. He's the one that called the Council of Nicaea.
Yeah.
And he was battering heads in there. He was looking for a way to make the empire cohesive and not be troublesome.
Right.
He was spreading Christianity, a Christianity that was viewed with tremendous favor by the pagans.
Yeah.
Pagans thought, oh, if you're in trouble or if you're hurt or if you need food, you go to the Christians. And this is even when they were underground still.
Now, talking about the manipulation of Constantine, that reminds me of some of the last temptations of the last temptation is our Satan character, Lucy the little girl, as you kept calling her.
Lucy!
Lucy is a fine name for her.
Lucifer!
offers change as generations, as you know, Jesus, this fulfills you. You have your own son now, of this slow generational thing that a life well lived is its own justice in the world, and that in my own thoughts about political justice and social justice, this idea of going slow, of gradual change, frequently comes up in the history of movements about that, and it's a position of privilege to be able to go slow, right? That we can say go slow, but while we're saying, well, they won't accept it yet, we need to slow down, people are dying. You know? Oppression is taking lives, whatever that oppression is. And that that Satan here really tempts with that go slow in a way was really interesting to me too. Now, obviously, the movie's Jesus, and I think the gospel's Jesus, obviously rejects violent revolution for its revolution of love.
This is something where we're trained to think there's winners and losers.
Right.
And we can't think in terms where everybody wins. Especially when you hear the term the judgment seat of Christ.
Yeah.
We think that when we go before the judgment seat of Christ, that there's going to be winners and losers. And I've been trying to explain this, that the judgment seat of Christ is to help us all become reconciled in justice, in righteousness, which is another word for it. And it's to help us so that we can love all the people in the who are, have been in our lives, who haven't been our friends, we would call them enemies.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus calls us to love our enemies. Well, there's has to be a way where God's going to work it out for everybody to feel that they've had justice.
Right.
So without some form of justice, which we should be trying to do here and now, not waiting for God to yeah. finally step in, that people can be in peace and harmony. And the word peace in Greek means holding hands in unison. It does not, it's not this term of not being at war with each other.
Right.
It's literally meaning hand in hand.
What is it, Isaiah? People cry peace, peace when there is no peace.
Right.
This idea of peace as just non-conflict. But peace isn't just non-conflict. Peace is justice. Peace is shalom. Peace is... bigger than that.
Yeah. Well, whenever you hear the word mercy, think of love.
Yeah.
Whenever you hear the word righteousness, think of justice. Justice for yourself, but justice for everyone else, too.
Yeah. I like that. I really like that. There were a couple of times where you asked me to stop and rewind the movie to listen to something again. The one that really interested me, you're talking about when John the Baptist sends Jesus out in the desert.
Well, if you won't listen to me, who will you listen to?
God.
The God of Israel is the God of the desert. If you want to speak to him, then you'll have to go to the desert.
I got here to me. Thank you, Baptist.
Be careful. God isn't alone out there.
John says that God's not alone out in the desert. And you paused it and you wanted to say that, but say also God's not alone in heaven. And I think that was a very interesting idea. If you're willing, sure.
We in the West, and also in the Orthodox Church, have problems with the concept of evil. Why does it exist? And we have stories in the Old Testament where people think that angels rebelled. And it's in there. It's a simplified explanation of it. But the real thing that we know from Genesis is that Adam and Eve disobeyed God, turned their back on God, and did something that they, in the end, were ashamed of and learned to avoid God. What we classically now call sin. You don't want to talk to God. You don't want to face Him. And giving us this free will that God did, making us in His image, where we're not robots, He had to give us choices. And without choices, there's no free will. So evil is part of God's way of helping us to pick. We have to have something to pick from. And in the movie, it said God's not alone. And immediately I was thinking of Satan, who gets blamed for everything.
Yeah.
He's an angel. And I don't think angels have free will. I think human beings have free will. And that Satan was assigned to be the choice.
Well, the popular understanding of Lucifer, Satan, even within the Christian church now, is almost a dualism of God as good and Satan as the evil deity fighting it out. What you're saying keeps in mind of Satan still as an underling. God,
he's God's creation. He's part of God's creation,
right.
And in Genesis it said, and God said, it's all good.
Yeah.
So God has Satan doing a role for our good.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think all will be reconciled.
Yeah. Now, another time you told me to pause it was a similar idea of Jesus telling Judas,
I have to die on the cross.
I won't let you die.
You have no choice, neither do I. Remember, we're bringing God and man together. They'll never be together unless I die. I'm the sacrifice. Without you, there can be no redemption. Forget everything else. Understand that.
No, I can't.
Yes, yes. That's another fine point. People want to go, oh, people who go, you're either saved or you're not saved. Well, Jesus isn't, Judas isn't saved. No. He's the culprit. He's the criminal.
Yeah.
But in this movie, it clearly says, without you, there's no redemption. He himself had a role to play.
Right.
You know, whether he did it by self-choice, or whether he knew that this was an assignment from God to do it. I think everyone's going to be there in eternity with God in the new creation. And so Judas and all the other negative people you can think of, because God loves all of his creation, not part of it.
It's really beautiful. I like that. Yeah. There's so much good in this movie.
Wonderful movie.
Now, I think this is actually only my second time ever watching it. And the first time I watched it was with you as well, when we did watched it for the Criterion Collection for my other podcast. You were living with me at the time then.
Yes.
We used to be roommates for a time. Because both of our lives are weird, you offered a lot of insight when I was watching this the first time, and I really, in all of my thinking about doing a podcast like this about talking about religion and film, talking to you about Last Temptation was one of the ideas that kept percolating in that. So I'm very happy to be able to have the first episode of this as it finally gets its wings with you.
Well, good. I hope people go watch the movie and read the book, and then start studying. Do the research on how the New Testament came together.
Yeah,
because it's really surprisingly similar.
Well, you've offered us a pretty good book list through this podcast too. Keister's New Testament, N.T. Wright, and
well, you also put down Keister's book about the Gospels that he wrote, I think, in 2016.
Yeah,
but that one takes a bit of preparation.
Yeah,
you need to be familiar with the scholarship that's gone on the last 20 years. So you need to read his first book.
Yeah, deep reading. It's you know, something Paul says in the New Testament about milk versus meat. You know, you got to have that foundation first before you're ready for the bigger ideas.
Yeah, and I think anyone who professes Christianity needs to understand that there's different ways to view how the New Testament came together, and then study the actual words. Right. Not what you've been told were the words, but the actual words.
And I think, you know, in a lot of Christian traditions, one of the reasons people are reticent to do that or encourage others to do that is this idea that it's all a house of cards, and you know, you remove one little bit and you're going to create an atheist. Whereas, you know, I think in practice, there's so many people I know who the more they learn, the deeper their relationship with it.
I trust that the Holy Spirit just guides you and that when you read the New Testament, you can stay out of the Old Testament for the first 20 years of your life, maybe the rest of your life. Hey, but you need the Gospels. You need to read the letters of Paul with the understanding that they're responses to questions he was given.
Right.
And, you know, but really, read the Gospels. Read the Acts. Those are good foundation stones.
Yeah.
And then you can learn about the rest of it.
Yeah. It's you know, you talk about love and loving, and immediately the first question always is, well, what do you mean by that? What's love? You know, the same thing Judas asks here, you know, so many times. But yeah, the Gospels, I think as 1 Corinthians 13 gives a pretty good working definition of what we mean when we talk about love, but it only ever comes up when we talk in marriage ceremonies.
Yeah. But, or on coffee cups.
Yeah. But love is patient, love is kind, and anything you do without love is useless noise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Clanging cymbal.
Clanging cymbals. Oh, well.
You're done.
Yeah, thank you so much, Thomas.
You're welcome.
Thanasi, as you introduced yourself. I don't know. I never know what to call you anymore.
The Mad Greek.
The Mad Greek.
Monk.
Brother Thanasi of Blacklick. It was a delight talking to you. And a delight,
thank you. Thank you.
Delight to have you on this show.
Maybe we'll do others.
I am still settling on a title. Do you have any suggestions? I put you on the spot right now.
For what?
The title of the podcast, of the project.
Faith and Flicks.
Faith and Flicks. I think that might actually be taken, but it might not.
Okay, Flicking Faith. I've been flicking my faith.
Now you're being naughty. Thank you for joining me, and thank you, listeners, for giving us a shot.
We'll see you
next time.
Bye.
Strength and mercy for me, and from me every day. Life and light will bleed into love, 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 love. Love.
Thank you for listening to Cinema Credo, Conversations on Film and Faith. I'm your host and writer, Adam Glass. Film clips this week are used under fair use. Thank you to Steve Richter for the use of our theme song, Madrasita, off of his album, Beloved. Check out his work at steverichter.com. That's steevrichter.com.